The Republic of Pirates by Colin Woodard, continued. Disc 10.
Rogers's situation deteriorated. Over the next few days, the Bahamas were racked with lightning, thunder, and rain, and Captain Whitney, expecting a hurricane, had his men take down the Rose's topmasts. Rogers tossed and turned in his humid bedroom with wrenching guts and a high fever. Progress on the fort moved at a snail's pace. Rogers's lieutenants barely able to get the reformed pirates to clear the scrub from around the fort, better yet to take part in the strenuous labor of salvaging cannon from the Hog Island wrecks and transporting them to the fort's bastions. The rain continued for 2 weeks, toward the end of which a boat arrived carrying men who, on examination, turned out to be members of Vane's company. These men confessed that Vane in a brigantine was headed north, but had promised to meet them around September 14th at Abaco, one of the Bahama Islands, 60 miles from Nassau. Was he headed north to join forces with Bonnet or Blackbeard? If so, was he preparing to make good on his threat to attack Nassau? On September 8th, there was more bad news. A boat arrived carrying John Cockrum's brother Philip and several other men who had been held captive by Spanish Guardas Costas for 2 months. During that time, they had been forced to serve as pilots for the Spaniards as they sailed around Abaco and New Providence, gathering intelligence for an imminent invasion. They had released Cockrum and his colleagues so that they could bring Rogers a message. Prove to us that you are a legitimate governor and not a pirate, or expect the worst. Rogers quickly drew up a letter to the governor of Havana while his lieutenants set about loading the buck with goods to trade at Cuba. The sloop of war departed on September 10th in the company of a smaller sloop, the Mumville Trader. The buck, however, never made it to Havana. En route, her crew, a mix of reformed pirates and Rogers's sailors, turned pirate. A number of the sailors who had come from England with the buck apparently found piracy attractive. The motivations of one of these men, Walter Kennedy, were later recorded. Kennedy, the young son of a whopping anchorsmith, had served in the Royal Navy during the War of Spanish Succession, where he had occasion to hear of the exploits of the pirates, from the time of Sir Henry Morgan to Captain Avery's more modern exploits at Madagascar. Inspired by these tales, Kennedy thought he might be able to make as great a figure as any of these thievish heroes whenever a proper opportunity offered. Kennedy seized that opportunity, apparently killing the buck's captain, Jonathan Bass, and other resistors before sailing away to Africa. With the loss of the buck, Rogers implored Captain Whitney to stay and help protect the island from Vane, who was now expected any day. Whitney delayed his departure by a week, but in the early morning hours of September 14th, over Rogers's strong objection, the Rose left Nassau. Whitney promised Rogers he would return in 3 weeks. It was a promise he had no intention of keeping. Rogers watched as his last naval escort vanished over the horizon on a southwesterly breeze. A few hours later, another boat came into the harbor bearing alarming news. Charles Vane had arrived at Abaco. After escaping from the buck on the evening of July 26th, Vane's exact movements remain sketchy. His company appears to have continued sailing south with the sloop Catherine, whose original pirate captain, Charles Yates, remained aboard, resentful and disgruntled. The pirates appear to have spent the first half of August bouncing between the southern Bahamas and the Cuban coast. On July 28th, they captured a sloop from Barbados, which was given to Yates and his men under the condition that they continue sailing in consort with Vane. 2 days later, another sloop, the John and Elizabeth, fell into their clutches, and not long after that, a brigantine, which Vane took command of. A London paper later reported that at about this time, two London-bound ships were set upon as they left Nassau by a pirate who, based on his behavior, was very likely Vane. The London Weekly Journal reported that the pirate captain had wanted to sink both ships, with their commanders and men, but that his crew would not consent to such an inhuman piece of barbarity. The pirates kept their captives for 5 days, during which time their captain promised to capture 2 more London ships that were expected to come to Nassau, saying he would cut him into pound pieces. While these pirates drank and cleaned their vessels at some secluded Bahama hideaway, another vessel arrived with supplies for them, plus news of where other pirates cruised and what men of war were out in chase after them. The captain was heard to brag that if there came 2 men of war to attack him, he would fight him, and if he could not escape them, he would go into his powder room and blow up his ship and send any of them on board and himself to hell together. In mid-August, Vane sent several men to Nassau to gather information and provisions, which they were to bring back to him at a secluded anchorage near Abaco. Vane appears to have been biding his time, observing his enemy, and hoping to eventually join forces with Blackbeard or Bonnet to attack the island. He may have even hoped that the Spaniards would attack, weakening or destroying Rogers's forces, creating a vacuum into which the pirates could return. In the meantime, he counted on old friends to buy his goods, smuggle vital provisions to his gang, and keep him abreast of happenings on New Providence. Toward the middle of August, his company's morale may have started to flag, because he decided to take a short cruise to Charleston in the hopes of filling the crewmen's purses. The pirates blockaded the harbor on August 30th, 1718. Vane and his 12-gun brigantine with 90 men, and Yates in a sloop, presumably the Catherine, of 8 guns and 20 men. The merchants of South Carolina had to have been appalled to be at the mercy of pirates once again, as vessel after vessel fell into their clutches. Over a 36-hour period, Vane and Yates took 8 in all, from the little 15-ton sloop Dove of Barbados to the 300-ton ship Neptune of London. From the 80-ton brigantine Dorothy of London, Vane seized 90 slaves from Guinea. Vane forced the Africans aboard Yates's sloop, which he intended to use as a floating warehouse. Yates, however, had other plans. His sloop, full of valuable human cargo, he took off in the other direction, intending to make his escape from his overbearing commander. Vane chased after him and got off at least 1 broadside, but was unable to prevent his underling's escape. Yates snuck his vessel into Edisto Inlet, 35 miles south of Charleston, and sent a messenger to that city offering to surrender if the governor would grant his men pardon. The governor ultimately agreed. Vane was undoubtedly furious about Yates's defection, but 2 other prizes gave him consolation. These were the 50-ton ship Emperor and the Neptune, both bound for London with pitch, tar, rice, and turpentine. These cargoes would find a ready market in the Bahamas, but they comprised 2,900 large barrels, far too bulky to transfer to Vane's modest brigantine. Instead, Vane's company resolved to take both ships to the Bahamas, where they could plunder at their leisure. They would go to their hideaway near Abaco, where they expected their informants and suppliers from Nassau to be waiting. Vane's men left Charleston not a day too early, for a posse was setting out to bring them to justice. The merchants of South Carolina had fitted out 2 well-armed, well-manned sloops under the command of Militia Colonel William Rhett, a wealthy merchant who had lost a good deal of money to the pirates over the years. By the time Rhett's vessels got out of Charleston's harbor, Vane was nowhere to be seen. Rhett decided to snoop around the North Carolina coast, hoping to find the pirates in one of their hideaways. On the afternoon of September 27th, he found some in Cape Fear Harbor. Not Vane's crew, who were halfway to the Bahamas by then, but another pirate company that just couldn't seem to catch a break. Poor Stede Bonnet. After Blackbeard had double-crossed him at Topsail Inlet, vanishing with the Spanish prize sloop and much of the company's treasure, Bonnet spent much of June 1718 trying to hunt him down. When he heard a rumor that Blackbeard was at Ocracoke Inlet, 50 miles up the North Carolina coast, he sailed there in the Revenge only to find a couple of deserted sandy islands. Bonnet fell into despair. He had been a pirate for more than a year and had little more than what he had started out with. His sloop, Revenge, a crew of 40 men, and thanks to the pardon from the governor of North Carolina, a clean legal record. As a pirate captain, he had been a total failure, his poor decisions having cost the lives of many of his men and the rest of his treasure. Any hopes he might have had to take part in a Jacobite uprising against King George had been dashed. The true king, known to them as James III, could barely help himself, better yet, the pirates of the Americas. Bonnet had a ruinous reputation in both respectable and outlaw circles, and he could not bear the humiliation of returning to either his old life among the slave plantations of Barbados or living among his pirate peers in the Bahamas. He would have to live on the fence. While getting his pardon in Bath, Bonnet learned that the King of Denmark, one of Britain's minor allies in the War of Spanish Succession, was still at war with Spain. Perhaps if Bonnet were to go to St. Thomas, Denmark's principal Caribbean colony, he could persuade its governor to grant him a privateering commission. His company thought it a good idea. Some of the pirates' former captives, like Captain David Harriet, signed up for the plan. When they left Beaufort Inlet, the pirates elected Robert Tucker as their quartermaster. Tucker was a mariner from Jamaica whom Blackbeard had seized from a merchant sloop some weeks earlier. Like many other captives, he found that he liked the pirate's life and had become a popular member of the crew. He had little respect for Bonnet and wasn't particularly interested in returning to being a law-abiding subject. When the crew discovered that the Revenge had but 10 or 11 barrels of food aboard, Blackbeard having stolen the rest, Tucker resolved that they should simply seize more from the next merchant vessel they encountered. Bonnet was opposed to this plan and even threatened to resign and leave the Revenge, but the crew didn't seem to mind the thought of losing him, and a majority threw their votes behind Tucker. The pirates seized the very next vessel they encountered, taking provisions. Then they took another. Pretty soon they were off the Capes of Virginia, taking every vessel they could lay their hands on. Bonnet tried to keep the company from invalidating his pardon. To conceal his identity, he insisted that he be called Captain Edwards or Captain Thomas, a ruse that didn't fool all their captives. To hide their tracks further, the pirates renamed the Revenge the Royal James in homage to James Stewart. Bonnet also insisted that the pirates give their captives payment for the goods they stole, so that they could claim that they were traitors, not pirates. Their first two victims received small parcels of rice, molasses, and even an old anchor cable in exchange for the barrels of pork and bread that were taken from them. After a week or two, however, most of the pirates refused to participate in this subterfuge, and some of Tucker's clique took to threatening and abusing captives instead. On July 29th, off Cape May, New Jersey, Tucker boarded the 50-ton sloop Fortune and fell to beating and cutting people with his cutlass and cut one man's arm, according to an eyewitness. 2 days later, they boarded a sloop anchored in the harbor of Lewis, Delaware, and threw themselves a party in the captain's cabin, eating pineapples, drinking rum punch, singing songs, and toasting the health of James Stewart, saying they hoped to see him king of the English nation, according to one of the sloop's crewmen. Tucker was, by now, captain in everything but name, and the pirates had even taken to referring to him as their father. Not all of the men aboard the Royal James wished to return to piracy, and took great risks to escape Tucker's clutches. Seven men successfully escaped on July 21st by stealing a prize sloop, which they took to Rhode Island. Authorities there imprisoned them, but five managed to escape before being brought to trial. When, after taking at least 13 vessels off New Jersey, Delaware, and Virginia, the pirates returned to Cape Fear to wait out the hurricane season, several forced men fled into woods. Unable to find food, shelter, or inhabitants in the swampy wilderness, the men had no choice but to return several days later and were put to work among the Negroes, cleaning the Royal James. One of the captives, a mulatto, lamented to another that he was not able to bear any longer, but was forced to comply with the pirates, for they told him they would have no regard for the color of his skin, but would make a slave of him. On another occasion, a pirate told the same mulatto captive that he was but like a Negro, and they made slaves of us all of that color if they did not join with the pirates. In Bonnet's company, it seems, both whites and blacks could choose between slavery and piracy. Bonnet did not try to escape from the Royal James as the company returned to piracy. The pirates planned to continue on to St. Thomas after hurricane season had passed, so he may have held out hope that he could still become a legitimate privateer in the service of Denmark. On September 27, 1718, the two South Carolina pirate-hunting sloops under Colonel William Rhett found the Royal James at anchor behind Cape Fear. The pirates were outnumbered by nearly 2-1, Rhett having the sloops Henry, 8 guns, 70 men, and Sea Nymph, 8 guns, 60 men, against Bonnet's 10-gun, 45-man sloop. Rhett lost the advantage of surprise, though, when he ran aground and was forced to take on the pirates in a full-on naval battle. Bonnet's company raised anchor and attempted to run straight between the South Carolinian sloops to the open sea. Instead, all three sloops ran aground, the Royal James and Henry within short range of each other. The pirates had the advantage as the Royal James happened to list on the starboard side so that her raised rail protected the pirates during the musket battle that followed. Colonel Rhett's Henry, by contrast, listed to port, exposing her entire deck to the pirates' fire. The two parties exchanged fire for the next 5 hours until the rising tide lifted the Henry free. Still immobilized and facing the Henry's cannon, the pirates surrendered. 9 died as a result of wounds received in the battle, as did 14 of Colonel Rhett's men. Bonnet, who had survived unscathed, was brought into Charleston on October 3rd and placed in armed custody, to the considerable joy of some, but not all, of the colony's inhabitants. He was the first prominent pirate captain to be captured by British authorities. By late July 1718, Blackbeard decided it was time to get back to work. He and his men had been involved in minor thefts. Witnesses reported that he was insulting and abusing the masters of all trading sloops and taking from them what goods or liquors he pleased. In their drunken revelries, he and his men had committed some disorders in Bath itself, according to North Carolina Governor Charles Eden, who perhaps encouraged Blackbeard to take his men to sea for a time. Governor Eden had already granted Blackbeard undisputed ownership of the Spanish prize sloop in which he had come from Beaufort. Now he signed customs papers clearing him to take the sloop, which Thatch unoriginally renamed Adventure, to St. Thomas, where he could keep his men occupied as privateers if he so desired. As it turns out, he didn't. Instead of going to St. Thomas, Blackbeard and his men apparently sailed up the Delaware River, 250 miles north, where he quietly went ashore at Philadelphia to sell some select treasures. Pennsylvania Governor William Keith later reported that Blackbeard had been seen on the city streets, and that he was well known among many people there because of visits to the city years earlier, while serving as a mate on a Jamaican vessel. In the early 1840s, a number of elderly Philadelphians would tell historian John Watson that in their youth they or their relatives had encountered Blackbeard and members of his crew, including an old black man who lived with a family of the brewer George Gray. According to their accounts, Blackbeard visited a store at 77 High Street, where he bought freely and paid well. He also was said to frequent a High Street inn, always wearing his sword by his side. Nobody dared arrest him for fear that his crew would come ashore and avenge his cause by some midnight assault. By the second week of August, the pirates having accomplished their business, the adventurer slipped out of Delaware Bay and into the open sea. It was time to refill their coffers far from their familiar stomping grounds. They sailed straight into the Atlantic in the direction of Bermuda, looking for foreign ships whose crews would be unlikely to be able to finger them for their crimes. They may have taken some vessels along the well-traveled sailing route from Philadelphia, but their first documented captures were on August 22, 1718, to the east of Bermuda. The victims were a pair of French ships, one heavily laden, the other largely empty, on their way home to France from Martinique. The French put up a fight, damaging the Adventure and wounding some of her men, but were ultimately overwhelmed by the pirates. Blackbeard's crew transferred all of the cargoes to one ship, which they kept, and all the French crewmen to the other, which was sent on its way. As Blackbeard began sailing back to North Carolina, he had no idea how much trouble this incident was to bring him. Around September 12th, they anchored their prize behind the sandy mass of uninhabited Ocracoke Island and began to unrig her, stripping the valuable masts, spars, and lines, and unloading the cargoes of sugar and cocoa. Blackbeard refused to allow anyone to board his vessels, a passing mariner later reported, except a doctor to cure his wounded men, who claimed to have been injured when a cannon shifted in rough seas. Leaving both vessels at Ocracoke on the afternoon of the 13th, Blackbeard and four black sailors headed up the Pamlico to Bath in one of their boats. He carried sweetmeats, loaf sugar, a bag of chocolate, and some mysterious boxes found aboard the French ship, all presents for Governor Eden's next-door neighbor, Tobias Knight, North Carolina's Chief Justice, and His Majesty's Collector of Customs. According to his four black crewmen, Blackbeard arrived at Knight's plantation about 12 or 1 o'clock in the night, gave Knight his gifts, and went into the house with him till about an hour before the break of day, at which point he ordered the men to head back down to Ocracoke. 3 miles down the Pamlico River, Blackbeard noticed a periagua tied up at the landing of an isolated farmhouse with two men and a boy aboard. Blackbeard decided to plunder this trading canoe and ordered his men to row alongside. William Bell, the owner of the periagua, had spent the night at John Chester's Landing and had seen Blackbeard's boat pass by earlier that evening. Bell's crew consisted only of his young son and an Indian servant, so when the five pirates came alongside his boat, he knew resistance would be difficult. At first, Blackbeard simply asked if Bell had anything to drink, to which Bell answered that it was so dark he could not well see to draw any from the cask. Blackbeard turned to one of his black sailors, who handed him a sword. He then jumped into the periagua and commanded Bell to put his hands behind him in order to be tied, and, swearing damnation seize him, he would kill Bell if he did not tell him truly where the money was. Bell, who was from Currituck, near the Virginia border, did not recognize Blackbeard and demanded to know who he was. Thatch replied that he came from hell and he would carry him presently there. Bell was able to tell authorities, despite having been foolish enough to have grabbed Thatch and tried to force him from the periagua. Blackbeard called to his men, who quickly subdued Bell. They then rowed the periagua out to the middle of the river with them and plundered her of pistols, brandy, a box of clay pipes, 66 pounds in cash, and a silver cup of remarkable fashion. Blackbeard then threw Bell's oars and sails overboard, and in retribution for his resistance, beat him with the flat end of his sword until it broke. Blackbeard continued on his way to Ocracoke. Bell must have gotten replacement oars at Chester's Landing, because 2 hours later he was at Tobias Knight's house in Bath to report the crime. Knight, Bell would later testify in court, listened patiently and filed a report, but never mentioned that the perpetrators had spent the night at his house. On September 24th, Blackbeard sailed up to Bath in the Adventure, where he reported to Governor Eden under oath that the French ship and goods were found by him as a wreck at sea. When an arch pirate comes to one's door, claiming to have found a vessel floating in the middle of the ocean, filled with valuables, and sufficiently seaworthy to be sailed some 700 miles back to North Carolina, one might have grounds to be suspicious. Eden and Blackbeard apparently had an understanding. The governor promptly declared the French ship to be Blackbeard's property by right of salvage, and a large parcel of sugar from the wreck somehow found its way into Chief Justice Knight's barn and hid itself under a pile of hay. Eden also gave Blackbeard permission to promptly burn the French ship as a hazard to navigation, conveniently eliminating any physical evidence that piracy had taken place. With the governor and Chief Justice in his pocket, North Carolina was shaping up to be a safer pirate lair than the Bahamas ever were. Blackbeard never would have guessed that the governor of another colony would have the audacity to invade. Chapter 11, Hunted, September 1718 to March 1720. Alexander Spotswood, the governor of Virginia, had been keeping tabs on Blackbeard for months. He had received intelligence of his intentional grounding of the Queen Anne's Revenge, his accepting the pardon from Governor Eden, and the subsequent depredations on trading vessels in the humid creeks of North Carolina. Spotswood had collaborated with the captain of one of the two naval frigates in Virginia, Captain Ellis Brand of the HMS Lyme, to send spies into North Carolina to make particular inquiry after the pirates. He'd even seized Blackbeard's old quartermaster, William Howard, who had taken the king's pardon and was hanging around Hampton Roads, under the pretense that he could not explain how he had acquired the £50 in his pocket or the two African slaves in his company. On these questionable legal grounds, Spotswood and Captain Brand had Howard forced aboard the Lyme and then incarcerated in Williamsburg's tidy brick jail. By interrogating Howard and debriefing his spies, Spotswood had assembled a detailed picture of what Blackbeard was up to, where he spent his time, and how he had bought the protection of the senior-most officials in North Carolina. In late October, he decided to act. Spotswood would later argue that Blackbeard represented a threat to Virginia's commerce, and that his presence encouraged others to piracy. All of this was true, but was not the real reason for Spotswood's decision to move against the pirate. Like politicians before and since, Spotswood intended to launch a military expedition abroad to divert public attention from his own improprieties at home. Spotswood governed the second most powerful colony on the American seaboard after Massachusetts, with a population of 72,500 whites and 23,000 blacks. It was entirely different from that northern colony. Virginia was a land of plantation manors surrounded by tobacco fields and the hovels of their servants and slaves. Each plantation had its own pier and served as a factory unto itself, its employees and human chattel producing most requisite products and services on site. As a result, there were hardly any towns or cities to speak of, the planters conducting much of their business at rural landings, churches, courthouses, and weekly markets. Even the capital, Williamsburg, was little more than an administrative center, a campus of elegant government buildings set near the brick buildings of the College of William and Mary. For most of the year, Williamsburg had a population of little over 1,000, administrators, craftsmen, teachers, and students. When the colony's aristocratic legislators met at the Grand Brick Capitol, Williamsburg came alive, its inns and boarding houses packed to bursting, its taverns bustling, and plays showing to enthusiastic audiences at British America's only theater, a 2-year-old structure on the east side of the carefully landscaped Palace Green. In recent years, the legislators came together to criticize Governor Spotswood and the culture of corruption he had nurtured during the 8 years he had overseen the colony. They drafted an official complaint over how he lavishes away the country's money on the nearly completed governor's palace, with its opulently appointed dining rooms, carved marble mantelpieces, formal orchards, gardens, and entry gates. Others were incensed at Spotswood's corrupt land dealings. He would eventually transfer 85,000 acres of public land to himself via blind trusts in an area which came to be known as Spotsylvania County. Most legislators opposed his imperious claim to control the appointment of all priests and high officials in the Anglican Church, the official religion of the colony. In 1717, the legislature had successfully petitioned the king to repeal some of Spotswood's economic regulations and was now working to remove him from office altogether. With so many enemies at his door, it was in strict secrecy that Spotswood met with Captain Brand of the Lyme and Captain George Gordon of the HMS Pearl in early October of 1718. He asked their assistance in ridding the Americas of Blackbeard, once and for all. In Nassau, Woods Rogers was also preparing to confront pirates. On September 14, 1718, he received word that Charles Vane was at Green Turtle Cay, near Abaco, 120 miles north of Nassau. Facing a Spanish invasion, and bereft of manpower or Royal Navy support, Rogers knew his only hope was to take a chance on the leaders of the pro-Parton pirate camp. Benjamin Hornigold and John Cockrum responded to the governor's call and agreed to become pirate hunters. Rogers outfitted a sloop for them, probably Hornigold's Bonnet, and dispatched them to gather intelligence and, if possible, confront Vane. They left Nassau 4 days later. Nobody saw them again for weeks. While awaiting Hornigold's return, Rogers tried to put Nassau's defenses in order. Nassau's governing council agreed to impose martial law, setting up a very strict watch, and ordering the island subjects and their slaves to help repair the fortress. Practically every night, however, pirates stole boats and fled the island, hoping to join Vane. Rogers estimated that 150 had abandoned him between the end of July and late October. As the days turned to weeks, Rogers began to fear that Hornigold was either taken by Vane or had begun his old practice of pirating again. Most islanders concurred. But 3 weeks after his departure, Hornigold's sloop sailed back into the harbor with a prize and a handful of pirate captives. Hornigold told everyone how he and Cockrum had spent most of the time hiding out near Green Turtle Cay, observing Vane and waiting for an opportunity to ambush him when away from his main force. Unfortunately, that chance never presented itself, and Hornigold and Cockrum judged Vane's company too powerful to take on directly. In addition to his pirate brigantine, Vane had the Neptune and Emperor with him, the two ships he had captured at the Charleston Bar, and his party spent most of their time plundering these ships and careening their vessels. After nearly 3 weeks had elapsed, the pirates said goodbye to the captive crews of the Neptune and Emperor, wishing them a good voyage home. But as they sailed from the anchorage, they spotted another sloop coming in. This, Hornigold was able to report, was the 30-ton sloop Wolf, which had sailed out of Nassau a few days earlier, with Rogers's permission to hunt sea turtles. In reality, the Wolf's captain, a pardoned pirate named Nicholas Woodall, was smuggling ammunition, supplies, and intelligence to Vane. Vane dropped anchor and consulted with Woodall, who gave him a detailed description of Rogers' activities and defenses. Vane, perhaps hoping his fellow pirates had risen up against the governor, was apparently disappointed. When one of the captives asked the pirates what news they had of Nassau, they replied none good, but bid him ask not many questions. The pirates, being very much disturbed with the news, voted to maroon the captives and destroy the Neptune by hacking down her masts and rigging, and then firing a gun, double-loaded with shot, straight into her hold. Vane's pirates left the harbor in the brigantine and the Wolf, at which point Hornigold sailed in to give the captives provisions and to let them know that help had arrived. That night, Hornigold sailed out in pursuit of the pirates, and a few days later intercepted the Wolf and brought her with him to Nassau. Hornigold's capture of the Wolf boosted Rogers' morale. "Captain Hornigold, having proved honest," Rogers wrote his superiors in London, "disobliged his old friends, divides the people here, and makes me stronger than I expected." Unsure of his authority to try Woodall, Rogers kept him in irons and sent him back to England on the next outward-bound ship. With the change in seasons, the weather also improved, and Rogers's people began recovering from their sickness. A convoy of trading sloops left the island to trade with friendly contacts in Cuba, from whom they hoped to secure additional supplies. With the fort almost complete and one of the leading pirates on his side, Rogers felt a growing sense of security. On November 4th, Rogers received word that the crews of all four trading sloops he had sent to Cuba had gone pirate and were intending to join Vane. The renegades were said to be at Green Turtle Cay, however, and might still be caught. Rogers again turned to Hornigold and Cockrum, who sailed to the island and engaged the recidivists in an all-out battle. The pirates, turned pirate hunters, came back to Nassau on November 28th with 10 prisoners, including Blackbeard's former gunner, William Cunningham, and the corpses of three more. Rogers was ecstatic. "I am glad of this new proof that Captain Hornigold has given the world to wipe off the infamous name he has hereto been known by," he wrote the British Secretary of State. "Though in the very acts of piracy he committed, most people spoke well of his generosity." The pirate prisoners presented a challenge, as Rogers lacked the men to ensure they stayed locked up. Trying and executing them in Nassau might spark an uprising. He called a secret session of his governing council, which now included the former Chief Justice, Thomas Walker, and laid out the options. More than anything, the councillors worried that Vane, tipped off by his numerous informants, might attempt to free the captives. "If any fear be shown on our part," they resolved, "it might animate several pirates now here to incite the pirates without to attempt the rescue of those in custody. Therefore, to prevent the designs of Vane the pirate," the council concluded, "they should, as soon as possible, bring the prisoners to trial." Lacking a jail, Rogers had the 10 prisoners chained aboard the Delicia before setting about what he knew was to be a risky confrontation with the island's pirate sympathizers. On leaving Green Turtle Cay, Vane headed north. The intelligence he'd received from Woodall suggested he would need reinforcements if he were to make good on his threat to attack Nassau. Having lost hope that the Stuarts would send assistance, Vane knew he had to turn to his old comrades for help. La Buse had vanished to the south. Williams, England, and Condent had sailed for Africa and Brazil. One pirate, however, was still in the region, and everyone knew where to find him. Vane's men agreed they would sail for North Carolina's Pamlico Sound, where they hoped to hook up with their comrade Blackbeard. They arrived at Ocracoke Inlet in the second week of October. There, behind Ocracoke Island, they spotted an armed sloop that would later prove to be Blackbeard's Adventure. There must have been a few minutes of confusion until the two parties identified each other, as neither was sailing in a vessel that was familiar to the other. Somehow, probably by speaking trumpet, Blackbeard and Vane confirmed each other's identity. Vane promptly saluted his comrade, firing his brigantine's guns high in the air, Blackbeard responding in kind. Vane anchored his vessel alongside the Adventure. Men rowed from one vessel to the other, commencing a pirate festival that would last several days and spread to the shores of Ocracoke Island. The two men shared their experiences over the past few months. Blackbeard was probably the first to inform Vane of Stede Bonnet's capture, an event that had been on everyone's lips from Charleston to Boston. Vane told Blackbeard about his confrontations with Pierce and Rogers at Nassau, and of the progress of the latter's government. Vane may have tried to convince his former partner to join him for a joint assault on New Providence. Blackbeard, comfortable in his new situation, declined. His men were safe and sound, free to continue their piracies without fear of reprisal. Their revelries concluded, Charles Vane and Edward Thatch took leave of each other to follow their separate paths. Governor Spotswood planned his attack on Blackbeard under a cloak of secrecy. He informed neither Virginia's governing council nor its legislature, and he certainly had no intention of airing the matter with Governor Eden. The pirates, he later explained, were simply too popular. I did not so much as communicate to His Majesty's council here, nor to any other person but those who were necessarily to be employed in the project's execution, least among the many favorers of pirates we have in these parts. Some of them might send intelligence to Thatch. He had grounds to worry. A few months earlier, some of Blackbeard's men had passed through the colony on their way to Philadelphia and had tried to tempt a number of merchant sailors to join them. Local officials wanted to arrest the pirates, but reported to Spotswood that they could find none willing to assist them in the disarming and suppressing of that gang. Spotswood did manage to arrest William Howard, Blackbeard's quartermaster, but shortly thereafter one of the judges of his own vice-admiralty court, a friend of Governor Eden named John Holloway, ordered the arrest of Captain George Gordon and Lieutenant Robert Maynard of the HMS Pearl, on which Howard had been detained. Holloway filed a civil suit against both naval officers on the pirates' behalf, seeking £500 in damages from each of them. Fearing a jury might let Howard go, Spotswood had him tried without one, a move strongly condemned by the governing council. Virginians, Spotswood sniffed, had an unaccountable inclination to favor pirates. It was at Howard's trial that Spotswood unveiled his plan to Captain Brand and Captain Gordon, who had been sharing intelligence with him for months. It was the perfect opportunity to meet with the Royal Navy officers without raising suspicions, their both being in Williamsburg to serve as officers of the court. After the trial, at which Howard was found guilty, Brand and Gordon walked the four blocks from the handsome H-shaped Capitol through the Market Square and down the Palace Green to the Governor's Palace. Within one of the palace's opulent rooms, Spotswood outlined his plan. Since Blackbeard shared his time between Bath and Ocracoke, there would be a two-pronged assault. Brand, as the senior-most officer, would lead a contingent of Marines overland to Bath, connecting with gentlemen sympathizers along the way. A second force would travel by sea to Ocracoke, ensuring no pirates escaped into the Atlantic. The Pearl, 531 tons, 40 guns, and the Lime, 384 tons, 28 guns, were both far too large to negotiate the dangerous shoals of North Carolina's brackish creeks and barrier islands. Instead, Spotswood offered to purchase at his own expense two nimble sloops, which would be placed at the officer's disposal. Brand and Gordon agreed to man, arm, and supply the sloops, and to place both under the command of Captain Gordon's first officer, Lieutenant Robert Maynard. Gordon himself would stay behind with the frigates at Hampton Roads. In addition to the possibility of claiming some of Blackbeard's treasure, naval personnel had an extra incentive to participate. Spotswood had just pushed a new law through the legislature rewarding a special bounty for the capture of Blackbeard or his minions. Gordon and Brand agreed to the plan. If it went well, it might prove both patriotic and profitable. Spotswood's plan was also entirely illegal, as neither the governor nor the officers had the authority to invade another colony. Blackbeard was, legally speaking, a citizen in good standing. He had been pardoned for his previous crimes, had applied for and received legal sanction to salvage his French wreck from Governor Eden, and had yet to be indicted for any crime. The expedition departed from Hampton on November 17th. Maynard, who was the oldest naval officer serving in America, climbed aboard his flagship, the Jane, the larger of the two sloops hired by Governor Spotswood. On board the Jane were 35 men, an ample supply of muskets, cutlasses, and swords, a month's worth of provisions, but no cannon, the Jane being too small to bear them. The other sloop, the Ranger, was even smaller, carrying 25 sailors under the command of Midshipman Edmund Hyde of the Lyme. With no cannon and only 60 men, Maynard knew that if his sloops were the ones to encounter Blackbeard, they would have to surprise him at anchor. At 3 a.m. on that November morning, they raised their anchors and sailed out of the Chesapeake. A few hours later, Captain Brand of the Lyme set out on horseback from the Hampton village with a small contingent of sailors. They rode on dirt tracks through the Virginia countryside, past empty fields and teams of slaves tending racks of tobacco leaves, drying in the cool fall air. The following day, the last fields, plantations, and roads fell behind them as they entered the trackless wilderness of North Carolina. They spent three agonizing days crossing miles of pine barrens and the aptly named Great Dismal Swamp before emerging on November 21st at Edenton, one of the colony's few settlements. Coming from the pastoral manors of Virginia, the poverty of the North Carolinians would have made an impression on Brand. The people indeed are ignorant, there being few that can read and fewer write, even of their justices of peace, another early 18th century visitor said of the area's inhabitants. They feed generally upon salt pork, sometimes upon beef, and their bread of Indian corn, which they are forced for want of mills to beat, and in this they are so careless and uncleanly that there is but little difference between the corn in the horse's manger and the bread on their tables. Two men were waiting for Brand in Edenton. They introduced themselves as Morris Moore, a colonel in the colony's militia and the son of the former governor of South Carolina, and Edward Moseley, the founding settler of Edenton, a wealthy and accomplished lawyer who had once been a member of North Carolina's governing council. Captain Brand described them as two gentlemen that have been much abused by Thatch. But they were also long-standing political opponents of Governor Eden, and were probably Spotswood's chief informants in the colony. Brand's party spent the night in or near Edenton, probably at Moseley's home, where the officer let it be known that he had come in to take Thatch. The next morning, Moseley and Moore arranged onward transportation across Albemarle Sound, and with several other residents, accompanied Brand on his final push to Bath, 30 miles further south. Brand and company reached the outskirts of Bath at about 10 o'clock on the night of November 23rd, 6 days after leaving Hampton. Moore scouted ahead and discovered that Blackbeard was not in town, as Brand had hoped he would be, but was expected any minute, with another load of cargo salvaged from the French ship. Leaving most of his men behind, Brand crossed the head of Bath Creek and went straight to Governor Eden's plantation house. There, Brand later reported, I applied myself to him and let him know I was come in quest of Thatch. Governor Eden must have been alarmed at Bran's surprise appearance in the company of two of his political rivals. He could only hope that Blackbeard had made his escape, and that Bran would not discover the large parcel of stolen goods hidden in the barn of his neighbor, Tobias Knight. It's easy to picture Bran sitting by Eden's fireplace until dawn, loaded musket at his side, waiting for Blackbeard to come down the stone path from Eden's dock. Blackbeard never came. As he sailed down North Carolina's outer banks, Lieutenant Maynard heard all sorts of stories about Blackbeard. His pilot, a North Carolinian hired by Spotswood, said Blackbeard had been ferrying stolen cargo between Ocracoke and Bath. At Roanoke Inlet, halfway down the outer banks, local mariners told them that the Monday before they had seen Blackbeard's adventure aground on Brant Island, a marshy islet on Currituck Sound, 30 miles back toward Virginia. Maynard spent the rest of the day sailing back and forth the length of Currituck Sound, but saw no sign of Blackbeard or anyone else. Spotswood himself had warned that Thatch was fortifying an island at Ocracoke Inlet and making that a general rendezvous of such robbers. From other mariners, Maynard probably heard another disturbing story that would reach Williamsburg a few days later. Blackbeard had been joined by some other pirate crews at Ocracoke, increasing his numbers to 170 men. Maynard had no way of knowing that Vane's pirate crew had come and gone 8 weeks earlier. At 4 p.m., with mounting trepidation, Maynard's small sloops reached Ocracoke Inlet, 30 miles south of Cape Hatteras. Once around the outer edge of Ocracoke Island, Maynard saw two sloops at anchor behind the island in a place now known as Thatch's Hole, one of them bearing 9 guns and matching the description of Blackbeard's adventure. The other sloop was unarmed and looked to be a coastal trading sloop. On the island, Maynard would have seen a large tent, the remains of bonfires, some empty kegs and barrels, perhaps, but no sign of fortifications. He took note of the wind and currents and the sun low in the sky and gave the order for the Jane and Ranger to drop anchor. He didn't want to engage Blackbeard in darkness. Since Vane had left, Blackbeard had indeed been traveling back and forth between Bath and Ocracoke, spending a couple of weeks overseeing 20 or so men at Ocracoke, then a couple of weeks with his wife in Bath. His return to town was, by now, overdue. 5 days earlier, November 17th, he had received a letter from Tobias Knight urging him to make the best of your way up as soon as possible, as I have something more to say to you than at present I can write. The justice had signed it, Your Real Friend and Servant, T. Knight. Blackbeard had more important matters to attend to than Knight or the two modest sloops that had just appeared in the inlet. His pirate gang was entertaining one of their merchant friends, Samuel Odell, whose trading vessel was anchored alongside the Adventure. While Maynard's men tried to sleep, steeling themselves for the fight ahead, Blackbeard's men drank late into the night. At 9 o'clock the following morning, Maynard gave the command to weigh anchor and sailed straight for the Adventure, hoping to board her before Blackbeard could roll out her cannons. As he entered the anchorage on the faintest of breezes, Midshipman Hyde's Ranger ran aground on a sandbar. He ordered his men to start throwing ballast stones overboard in the hopes of making the sloop light enough to get back afloat. Maynard pressed ahead in the larger Jane, only to run aground himself, eliminating any possibility of a surprise attack. Despite their hangovers, Blackbeard's men couldn't help but take notice of the two sloops that had clearly been trying to sneak up on them, and whose suspiciously large crews were now noisily throwing ballast and water barrels over the side in an urgent attempt to get free. When it dawned on them that they were under attack, the pirates sprang into action, rushing to loosen sails, cut the anchor cables, and ready the cannons. It happened so fast that their guest, Samuel Odell, and his three crewmen didn't have time to get off Blackbeard's vessel. Just as the adventurer's sails caught their first faint breath of wind, Hyde got the Ranger afloat and headed straight for the pirates, with most of his 25 men straining at the oars. The pirates began firing their muskets, and when the vessels had closed to within half a pistol shot, Blackbeard signaled the gun crews to fire. Flames blasted from the muzzles of the adventurer's cannons, and a split second later, 4- and 6-pound cannonballs tore across the Ranger's foredeck, demolishing foresails and killing Hyde and his second-in-command, the Lime's coxswain, Alan Arlington. Wounded men convulsed on the Ranger's blood-soaked deck as the sloop slowed to a stop. Amid the confusion, some of the sailors managed to let off a volley of small arms fire as the adventurer swept past. One of the musket balls severed the jib halyard, the line holding up the pirate's foresails, causing the adventurer to lose speed. This was a critical piece of luck for Maynard's men. Having gotten the Jane free, they now rowed madly toward the pirates in the hope of boarding them. Had the halyard not been hit, the adventurer could have escaped into the open sea. Instead, the two vessels closed to within 50 feet of each other. At this point, Blackbeard hailed Maynard. "Damn you villains! Who are you, and from whence came you?" he said, according to the general history. "You can see by our colors we are no pirates," Maynard is said to have replied. Thatch, his beard tied in black ribbons, held up a glass of liquor and, according to Maynard, drank damnation to me and my men, whom he styled cowardly puppies, saying he would neither give nor take quarter. Maynard responded that that was fine with him. Blackbeard then signaled to his gunner, Philip Morton, to unleash his other broadside. Morton had loaded the guns with grape and partridge shot that yielded a shotgun-like discharge that was extremely deadly at such close range. Other pirates threw improvised hand grenades they had made by stuffing gunpowder, musket balls, and bits of old iron into empty rum bottles. When the smoke lifted, the Jane's deck was covered with bodies. In just a few seconds, 21 of Maynard's crew had been killed or wounded. Only 2 men were still standing on the sloop's deck. The battle, Blackbeard concluded, was won. He ordered the adventurer to come alongside the Jane and for his men to prepare to board. Under cover of gunpowder smoke, however, Maynard had ordered a dozen or so uninjured men to hide in the Jane's hold and await his signal. Crouching at the ladder, he whispered instructions to his helmsman and his first mate, Mr. Baker, telling them to lie low and to signal to him when the pirates came over the side. When the adventurer banged against the Jane, Blackbeard was the first over the rail, with a rope in his hands to lash or make fast the 2 sloops. At Baker's signal, Maynard rushed up from the hold, sword in hand, 12 crewmen behind him. In a scene that inspired many Hollywood movies, Blackbeard and Maynard faced off against each other, dashing naval lieutenant and fearsome pirate, swords drawn. Humphrey Johnson, the North Carolina mariner who carried the news of the battle to New England, described the fight this way. Maynard, making a thrust, the point of his sword went against Teach's cartridge box, where he stored his ammunition, and bended it to the hilt. Blackbeard then delivered a blow that shattered the guard of Maynard's sword, slicing the officer's fingers. Maynard jumped back, threw away his sword, and fired his pistol, which wounded Teach. By now, 10 of Blackbeard's men had clambered aboard the Jane and were clashing with Maynard's men. In the chaos, the Jane's helmsman, Abraham Demmelt, made his way to Maynard's side and managed to slash Blackbeard across the face. The pirates aboard the Jane were outnumbered by Maynard's men and rapidly fell to the blood-stained deck. More men trained their pistols on Blackbeard, who staggered on, swinging his sword at Maynard and Demmelt, blood gushing from his face and body. More musket balls struck his tall frame as the sailors surrounded him, swords drawn, circling for the kill. According to Humphrey Johnson, the final blow came from a Scots Highlander who, decapitated Blackbeard with a powerful swing of his sword, laying it flat on his shoulder, attached by a bit of flesh. The author of the General History disagrees, saying Blackbeard expired suddenly as he was cocking another pistol, finally succumbing to his wounds. In letters to friends and relatives, Maynard didn't say how Blackbeard died, but noted that he fell with 5 shot in him and 20 dismal cuts in several parts of his body. The melee had lasted less than 6 minutes, during which time all of the boarding pirates were slain, without killing a single one of Maynard's men, though he reported several were miserably cut and mangled. The ranger came alongside to help finish off the pirates remaining aboard the Adventure, who were outmanned by nearly 3-1. Many jumped in the water, where the naval sailors picked them off one by one. According to Captain Gordon's post-action report, one of the pirates made it to shore, succumbed to his injuries, and was discovered some days after in the reefs by way of the fowls hovering over him. One of the ranger's sailors had been killed by friendly fire, bringing the Navy's total casualties to 11 dead and over 20 wounded. The victors had one final scare outside the Adventure's powder room. They discovered a black pirate named Caesar, match in hand, struggling to get free of the merchant Samuel Odell and one of his crewmen, so he could follow Blackbeard's last command. In the event of defeat, blow them all to smithereens. Caesar was successfully restrained and became one of 14 pirate prisoners, 9 white and 5 black, that were taken into custody. Odell, his body bearing no less than 70 wounds, was also taken prisoner, though he was later released. After the battle, Maynard's men searched the Adventure, hoping to find a hoard of Spanish gold and silver. Instead, they found some gold dust, a few items made of silver, including the goblet stolen from William Bell, and other small things of plunder. They also found Tobias Knight's recent letter to Blackbeard, and a number of papers implicating Knight and Eden in Blackbeard's piracy. The tent on the shore concealed the remnants of the French ship's cargo, 140 bags of cocoa and 10 casks of sugar. If Blackbeard had accumulated fantastic wealth, he had not kept it with him at Ocracoke. Whether severed during or after the battle, Blackbeard's head was strung up in the Adventure's bowsprit, a grotesque trophy that would fetch the sailors £100 bounty when they got back to Virginia. Maynard had Blackbeard's headless body thrown into Pamlico Sound, where, according to legend, it swam around the Adventure 3 times before sinking into the brackish water. Owing to a spate of rough weather, Maynard and Brand didn't meet up until November 27th, when the lieutenant came up to Bath to deliver the evidence found against Knight and Eden. Brand was already furious with Knight, who he said was making an abundance of difficulty, advising the governor not to assist me, and constantly justifying the pirates. The Chief Justice had positively denied that any pirated goods were about his plantation. Brand now confronted Knight with incriminating evidence from Blackbeard's letter, the memorandum in Thatch's pocketbook, and statements from several witnesses who had taken part in unloading plunder. Knight finally owned the whole matter, and showed Brand 20 barrels of sugar and 2 bags of cotton covered with fodder in his barn. Eden, seeing the game was up, ordered his marshal to deliver to Brand 6 slaves and 60 hogsheads of sugar that had belonged to Blackbeard or his men and had been in the governor's possession. Brand also tracked down several pirates lurking in Bath, including Blackbeard's bosun, Israel Hands, who would ultimately agree to testify against his companions in exchange for his life. The total value of the cargo found in Bath and Ocracoke was estimated at £2,238, including the Adventure herself. Lieutenant Maynard returned to Hampton Roads in the Adventure on January 3, 1719. Blackbeard's head still hanging from the bowsprit. As he passed the HMS Pearl, he saluted Captain Gordon with all 9 of the Adventure's guns. Gordon treated his lieutenant to a rare honor, an equal return salute from one of His Majesty's frigates. Gordon and Maynard presented Blackbeard's head to Governor Spotswood, who had it suspended from a tall pole on the west side of the Hampton River at a place now known as Blackbeard's Point, as a ghoulish admonition to would-be pirates. In a few weeks, Maynard would be a household name from New England to London, Port Royal, and beyond. In Boston, 13-year-old Benjamin Franklin, then a printer's apprentice, wrote and published a sailor's song about Maynard's accomplishment, which he sold on the street. The text has been lost, save for one stanza ending with the lines, "It's better to swim in the sea below than to swing in the air and feed the crow," says Jolly Ned Teach of Bristol. The expedition kept the court system busy for many years as the various parties tried to settle their scores with one another. On March 12, 1719, the prisoners were tried at the capital in Williamsburg, and apart from Samuel Odell, found guilty. 13 pirates were executed. Their bodies hung in gibbets, strung along the Hampton-Williamsburg Road. The last, Israel Hands, was freed just prior to execution, owing to the timely arrival of a ship carrying an extension of the king's pardon, an event that also saved William Howard. Based on evidence gathered by Brand and Maynard, Tobias Knight was brought to trial in North Carolina for colluding with the pirates. He was found not guilty, largely because he managed to have the testimony of Blackbeard's 4 black crewmen thrown out, because, as he argued, by the laws and customs of all America, the testimony of blacks was not of any validity against any white person whatsoever. Governor Eden threatened to prosecute Brand for trespassing on the lands of the Lord's proprietor of North Carolina, and sparred for months with Spotswood over both the legality of the invasion and the ownership of plunder, though these efforts came to naught. Edward Moseley and Morris Moore broke into an official's home in an unsuccessful attempt to find evidence linking Eden with Blackbeard, and were caught, tried, and convicted of sedition. For his part, Robert Maynard filed an unsuccessful lawsuit against Gordon and Brand after the captains decided to share Spotswood's bounty money among the crew of the Lyman Pearl, not just those who had fought at Ocracoke. In the end, most sailors received only £1 for their part in the battle. In Charleston, the courts had not only been busy, they had literally been under siege. The inhabitants were at odds over the fate of Stede Bonnet and the other pirates Colonel William Rhett had captured at Cape Fear. Most colonists were undoubtedly pleased that perpetrators of some of the recent blockades were finally being brought to justice. This sentiment was particularly strong among merchants and planters who had lost ships and cargo in these incidents. But there were a great many people in Charleston who supported the pirates, and their passion exceeded that of their counterparts in North Carolina or Virginia. This faction included a large number of pardoned pirates and former Nassau smugglers, as well as servants, sailors, free blacks, and other members of South Carolina's enormous underclass. Bonnet, they argued, was a gentleman, a man of honor, a man of fortune, and one who has had a liberal education. His crewmen were seen as heroes, men unafraid to seize the goods of wealthy men or to drink to the damnation of Britain's so-called king. They insisted none too quietly that all the pirates should be freed. Like Woodes Rogers in Nassau, Governor Johnson was not at all sure that he could keep the pirates in custody. South Carolina had just fought a major Indian war, thus manpower was in short supply. Charleston had no jail, so Johnson had been forced to incarcerate the pirates in the Court of Guard, a small 2-story building that stood on the Half Moon Battery, a fortification on the Bay Street waterfront. The structure's wooden walls had numerous windows, making it less than secure, despite the presence of armed guards. As a concession to Bonnet's gentility, and to keep him from plotting with his men, Johnson had the pirate captain held at the home of Nathaniel Partridge, the colony's provost marshal, where sentinels were placed early in the evening to guard against jailbreaks. Through these improvised arrangements, Johnson hoped to hold the pirates from October 3rd, when they were brought in, until October 28th, when their trial was scheduled to begin. Nonetheless, on the night of October 24th, 1718, Bonnet escaped from the marshal's house with the help of Richard Tookerman, a merchant who had made a small fortune smuggling goods back and forth to the Bahamas when they were under pirate rule. Marshal Partridge may have been complicit in the escape, which apparently took place without a struggle. He was fired a few days later. Curiously, Bonnet escaped in the company of David Harriet, a forced man who would almost certainly have been acquitted, as he had turned state's evidence that very morning, giving a lengthy deposition against the pirates. He had been moved from the court of guard to the marshal's house as a reward for his cooperation. Yet Harriet chose to flee into the night with Bonnet. By the time the alarm was sounded, they were halfway across the harbor in Tookerman's canoe, paddled by several of his black and Indian slaves. Not long thereafter, Charleston descended into civil disorder. The details of what came to be called the disturbances are unclear, but from passing references and subsequent legal documents, it appears that an armed mob lay siege to the court of guard in an attempt to free the remaining pirates. We can't forget how long this town has labored under the fatigue of watching the pirates, and what disturbances were lately made with a design to release them, Assistant Attorney General Thomas Hepworth said a few days later. We were apparently in danger of losing our lives in the late disturbance when, under a notion of the honor of Carolina, the rioters threatened to set the town on fire about our ears. The attack, Hepworth concluded, shows how necessary it is that the law be speedily executed on them to the terror of others and for the security of our own lives. The trial started on October 28th, and when they concluded on November 5th, 29 of the 33 prisoners had been found guilty. 22 were hanged 3 days later at White Point, a marshy tongue of land sticking out from the southern end of the Charleston Peninsula. Meanwhile, while paddling to North Carolina, Bonnet and Harriet encountered a storm that forced them ashore on Sullivan's Island, just 4 miles south of Charleston. There, on November 8th, they were ambushed by yet another posse, led by William Rhett. There was a brief exchange of gunfire, in which Harriet was killed and 2 slaves injured. Bonnet was captured, carried to Charleston, and on November 12th found guilty of piracy. By an odd coincidence, the Chief Justice was Nicholas Trott, nephew and namesake of the disgraced governor of the Bahamas, who had helped Henry Avery go free. If Bonnet entertained hopes that Trott's nephew might grant him leniency, he was disappointed. "You shall go from hence to the place of execution," Justice Trott told him, "where you shall be hanged till you are dead." Bonnet was said to have made such a pathetic display on hearing the sentence that a number of Charleston citizens, most of them women, applied to the governor to spare his life. According to the author of the General History, the governor was also approached by some of Bonnet's friends with a proposal to send the gentleman pirate to England so that his case might be referred to His Majesty. Colonel Rhett is said to have offered to go with Bonnet and to raise funds to pay for the trip. These and other interventions prompted Johnson to delay Bonnet's execution 7 times, the London Original Weekly Journal later reported, a situation that so angered the city's merchants that they approached the governor in a mass and demanded immediate execution on the offender. Bonnet, fearing the end was near, wrote a plaintive letter to the governor, begging him to look upon me with bowels of pity and compassion, and to think me an object for your mercy. Make me a menial servant to your honor and this government, and you will receive the willingness of my friends to be bound for my good behavior and constant attendance to your commands." The governor was unmoved. On December 10, 1718, Major Stede Bonnet was led to the gallows at White Point and hanged.
This audiobook is continued on Disc 11.